On this week's show, Chris Van Zyl retires. We break down the Ticats' offensive and defensive lines and where they rank amongst their East Division counterparts, the latest on the Chad Kelly lawsuit, and I have some thoughts on a slew of things, replica mini helmets, and why does anyone give a damn about theme nights? Read 'em, Tiger Cats! Welcome to Podski Weeby. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham.
We are going to start things off today with some not-so-surprising news, Mike, and that is Canadian offensive lineman Chris Van Zyl has announced his retirement. He was a former third-round pick of the Montreal Alouettes as a defensive lineman out of McMaster University in 2007. He ended up playing 15 seasons in the CFL with the Ticats and Argos. Despite being drafted by the Owls, he never played for them. Began his career with Toronto in 2008, made the transition from defensive to offensive line, and it was a pretty darn good one. He played 11 seasons in double blue. He won a pair of Grey Cups in 2012 and 2017. He was then released, if you recall, just ahead of training camp in 2019. Immediately, I think it was the day of or the next day, signed with the Ticats, where he became an integral part of the team that would set a franchise record that year with 15 wins in the regular season. At the end of the year, he would win his only most outstanding offensive lineman award, beating out Stanley Bryant. Last few years, though, I think it's fair to say weren't kind to him. Dealt with injuries quite a bit. Very rarely saw the field. But he ends his career as a two-time Grey Cup champion, three-time league all-star, seven-time division all-star, one-time most outstanding lineman. In my opinion, that's a Hall of Fame resume if I've ever seen one. But Mike, what are your thoughts on Van Zyl's retirement? What did you think when you heard the news that he was calling it quits?
Well, like you, I wasn't very surprised. It's been a little bit of a downward trajectory over the last couple of years for him, you know, with the injuries and, you know, getting up there in age. It's been tough on him. I know that he would have been a great depth guy going forward for the offensive line. But, you know, you get to a certain age and you want to call it quits. But yeah, I'm with you. Hall of Fame career, in my opinion, to go from the defensive line, you know, playing up to his college career on the defensive line and then switching and having a Hall of Fame career on the offensive line is pretty damn impressive. Obviously, he played with the filthy Argonauts for a long period of time, but we won't hold that against him. But I'd also like to mention that he did a lot of things off the field as well. He had an incredible impact on the Hamilton community. I'm sure he did great things in Toronto, but he has contributed to many community initiatives in Hamilton, including United Way Halton and Hamilton Sleepless Inner Cities, where he sleeps overnight in his car. He was part of TELUS and Bullying All-Stars, Interval House of Hamilton's Be More Than a Bystander, the Steel Coal High School Mentorship Program, Hamilton Health Sciences, and the Children's Aid Society. So a Hall of Fame guy on the field and a Hall of Fame guy off the field, and my hat goes off to a tremendous career.
Yeah, local guy too. Born in Font Hill, went to Notre Dame High School in Welland, played for McMaster. I always wanted him to play for the Ticats. I wish we would have had the opportunity to get him earlier in his career, because he was so good with Toronto. But for him to end, I remember when they signed him in 2019, it was like, oh, this could be the key to this team maybe unlocking something. And they go on to have the best season in franchise history, at least in the regular season, obviously make the Grey Cup. We all remember what happens there. But he wins his only, which is surprising to me, and maybe because he's Canadian, maybe because he plays right tackle. He beats out Stanley Bryant for that award in 2019. Stanely Bryant, I think, won the two previous to that, and then won the two after that. So Stanley Bryant might be the best offensive lineman this league's ever seen. And if I recall correctly, the vote was really, really close. And I think it was probably the fact that Hamilton was so good that kind of pushed Van Zyl over. Maybe it was also kind of a career achievement award as well, especially with offensive line play. So few people, I think, really, I don't want to say understand it, but it's not something most people pay attention to, if we're being perfectly honest. Like, you're an offensive line nut, so you do, but very few people really watch the game from an offensive line perspective. But he had a tremendous career. I don't think there's any chance he doesn't make the Hall of Fame. Like, I know that comes, sometimes we anoint those people a little early, you know what I mean? Like, how many times have you watched a game in any professional sport and you hear future Hall of Famer attached to their name and you're like, him, really? Like, I remember Philip Rivers, great quarterback for the San Diego Chargers. I remember probably about 10 years into his career, he put up some great numbers, and it was like, oh, he's a surefire Hall of Famer. And it's like, is he? Like, is he actually? Like, but with Van Zyl, I think it's no doubt that he's going to, as a Canadian playing tackle, the accolades speak for themselves. It's weird though. Like, do you look at him still as an Argo or more as a Ticat? Like, I know he only played 4 years in Hamilton and didn't really play. I mean, he played excellent in 2019. He was an East Division All-Star in 2021, but the last 2 years, I could probably count on two hands the amount of games he actually played last year in particular. I don't think he started a single one. And obviously age, as he's 41 years old. So age obviously has something to do with that. But do you look at him and still think of the Argos primarily, or is he a Ticat to you?
He's a Ticat to me just because I wasn't paying attention to him when he was with the Argonauts, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I could give a damn about Chris Van Zyl when he's with the Argonauts. And especially since we've been starting to do this podcast, and I know that we started well before he came to Hamilton, but my attention on the offensive line has grown so much since we started this thing up. So, Van Zyl to me is a Ticat, even though he played, you know, only 3 or 4 seasons with them and the majority of his career is with the Argonauts. I see him as a Hamilton Tiger guy.
It'll be interesting to see if he, because you mentioned all the off-field stuff he did. And obviously, I think that's something that he would probably like to continue in his post-football career. Obviously, with Simone Lawrence now kind of being the brand ambassador, I do wonder if he'll be able to kind of recruit former teammates to join him in some of these initiatives that I'm sure he's going to be a part of. I do wonder if Van Zyl will be more likely or more, because I think he still lives in like the Font Hill, Thorold, Welland area. Like, I don't think he ever really moved out of there. So I am curious if he might end up doing more community work post-career with the Ticats than he would with the Argos, which would kind of solidify that he's a Hamilton guy, right? Like, if you see him at community events in the black and gold after, now that his career's over, it makes you think that maybe he has a little bit more attachment to the Tabbies than he does to the filthy Argos, as you like to call them.
Yeah, and, being a guy that went to college in Hamilton and all that stuff, hopefully he stays on the right side of things and, continues his, post-football career representing the Hamilton Tiger Cats.
For sure. So with his retirement, we were going to cover this anyway, but it just happens to be a nice cohesion here. Van Zyl had his foot on both sides of the offensive and defensive lines, even though professionally he never played defensive line. So we're going to continue covering, breaking down the position groups for the Ticats as we head towards the start of training camp, which, believe it or not, is like less than a month away, which feels insane to think. But we haven't covered the two lines yet, so we're going to do those today. We're going to start with where Van Zyl's presence will be most missed, obviously, and that's the offensive line. I think, though, that despite losing a future Hall of Famer, I think Hamilton's O-line looks to be in pretty good shape. Now, part of that is Van Zyl really didn't play a lot last year, but also they bring back pretty much everyone, and hopefully they'll be healthy. And I think this could be one of the best units in the league if everyone stays healthy. Joel Figueroa is back at left tackle. He took a pay cut this offseason following a season where he missed 13 games due to injury, which was his bugaboo in Hamilton and then wasn't after he left and then became it again. And it was very frustrating last season. Brandon Revenberg, Coulter Woodmansey, and Jordan Murray all returned after signing extensions this past winter. And David Beard is back his second full season to be the team center. The Ticats also still have former first-round draft pick Dayton Black, who they selected in last year's draft. And they signed a fellow former first-rounder in Evan Johnson away from the Saskatchewan Roughriders. So, Mike, as our resident O-line guy, what are your thoughts on this group, specifically the starters? Do you like it? Do you dislike it? Are there some guys that we haven't brought up yet? Your newcomers, maybe some younger American veteran players, like, say, a Brandon Kemp, mm-hmm. who you're interested in seeing maybe get some time here? Or are you happy with, potentially, should everyone stay healthy, and that's obviously the big caveat here, the Ticats going to the season with these five guys as their starting unit?
I think this is the best starting offensive line we've had since we've started the podcast.
Even better than 2019?
It might be. I'm not positive about that, but going into the season, this is like the most excited I've been about the offensive line. Okay. Maybe take away Joel Figueroa worries me a little bit at that left tackle position just because of the injuries. I mean, 13 games, that's a lot of games to miss in a season. But if these guys are healthy, that starting five is killer. And then you look at some of the depth behind it. I have a lot of confidence in Dayton Black. He got a little bit of time last year, and he didn't look out of place as a rookie. You mentioned Kemp. He got some playing time last year and played pretty darn good. You got guys like Jacob Zott, if that's how you pronounce his name. We have a lot of depth as well. So even if there are injuries, like say Joel Figueroa goes down, Kemp can slide into that position and do a pretty darn good job. Not to mention that he's 6'7" and 3'10", an absolute monster. But I'm overjoyed about the offensive line this year. I have very high expectations for them, and I agree with you. If they can stay healthy, they can be one of, if not the best offensive line in the league, and we're going to need them to be near the top of the league if we want to have success on offense this year.
No, not put any high expectations on this group whatsoever. They're a versatile group though too, right? Like Revenberg can play tackle, can play center, can play guard. He starts at guard. That's where he's an all-star, where he's, and I'm going to use the word, potentially a future Hall of Famer playing that position. But in a pinch, he could kick out and play tackle if he had to, or play center. Wood Manzi is also a versatile guy, has played, he played tackle at the collegiate level when he was at Waterloo, but has played some center with the Ticats, but has found a home at guard. Jordan Murray can play both the left and right side. So you're right. If Joel Figueroa goes down, maybe Brandon Kemp goes to the left side, or maybe Jordan Murray kicks over to left and you throw Brandon Kemp on the right side. They have Evan Johnson they brought over, who's been a multi-time starter for the Red Blacks and the Rough Riders. I know a lot of Rough Rider fans fell out of, he's a Saskatchewan boy, and a lot of, they expect a lot of him. They fell out of love with him, so they were mocking the decision to sign him. But as a sixth or seventh offensive lineman who's not going to really have to start, who would only really need to come in a pinch, I don't think that's a bad signing whatsoever. He spent how many, I think he was a first round pick in like 2017, maybe 2018. Like he's been around for a while, so it's not as if he's carved out a career for himself. And I think it's never a bad thing to have more veteran help on the offensive line should guys go down, because guys are going to get hurt on the O-line. I think it's just the nature of the position, right? But I think they have depth. I think they have a really good starting five should everyone stay healthy, and they have the versatility in their guys that if something were to happen, I don't think Revenberg going down would be, I think, the biggest blow, honestly. Beard going down, I think, would hurt too. But it feels different than in years past when we've gone into the season and we're worrying about the tackles. And even last year, though, as I think we were both pretty high on the group, it was still, yeah, the injury bug with Figueroa. And then he does get hurt. And that did kind of throw a monkey wrench in things. It did kind of hurt things. But I look at it now and I feel like they've done a really good job. And they've spent some money, don't get me wrong, on building this unit up and having it in a spot where, should something catastrophic happen, should Joel Figueroa go down again? And I think at this point in his career, much like with Bo Levi Mitchell, much like Chris Van Zyl for the last couple of seasons, you kind of just have to pencil it in that he's probably not playing the full 18. I don't think they'll be in a difficult spot, or they won't be in as dire of straits should they need to make a swap and bring some other guys in. I think they're in a pretty good position. Now, we thought this last year and it didn't really work out all that well, but I look at this on paper and with full health, it gets me pretty excited.
Yeah, and I'm looking at some of the ages of these guys. The oldest guy on the offensive line is Joel Figueroa. He's 34, and then the next oldest is 31, and then everyone else is either 30 or younger. So I kind of like the youth move, and we'll talk about the D line in a bit here, but both lines are pretty young. It's good to have some veteran help, don't get me wrong, we need some vets, but to have, like, as a whole, that unit be fairly young, I think that's a good thing.
Well, and we've gone the veteran route on both sides, right? Like we had Van Zyl who couldn't stay healthy. Defensively, there was Ted LaRon who stayed healthy, but you could kind of tell he was nearing the end. Jagaire Davis was in his 30s and looked cooked last. Like to get younger guys that I think are ascending into their prime versus guys, like there's always that saying in football, it's better to release a guy a year too early than a year too late. I think out of loyalty to some of these guys last year and this year, like let's be honest, if the team would have let go of Chris Van Zyl last offseason, I think there would have been outrage at first, but then you kind of look at what he produced last year and you're like, oh, maybe they could have saved some money by letting him walk, you know what I mean? And yeah, sure, they kept him around. He did play and he was fine, but he wasn't Chris Van Zyl. I think we've seen this team undertake something where instead of relying on what guys used to do, they're going to go with guys who are entering those prime years versus guys who maybe have 1 year left. You know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely. I feel the same way about the offensive line and the defensive line. So it's, we always make our predictions and we go through this every year. And most of the time we're pretty positive about the moves, but I feel extra confident about this offensive line this year. I just think that they've done a really, really good job of building it up.
That means something too, because I'm usually the overly optimistic one and you're usually, I won't say pessimistic one, but you're definitely more grounded than I am. I'm usually pie in the sky. So for you to be that high, I think that speaks well to what the team has done. At least hopefully it does. Let's look at the groups across the division though, and look at kind of where these Ticats stack up. So you look at the Argos last year, without question, the best starting five of any team in 2023. And the entire group returns in 2024. The Owls got better as the season went on last year. Do you remember when they started the season? They were absolutely atrocious offensive line. But then they got really good as the season went on. Obviously, they win the Grey Cup. And then there's the Red Blacks. They added a potential stud in Darius Bladeck. But I think you look at their group, and there's still some questions there. A lot of guys return, but a lot of guys returned from a line that, quite frankly, underachieved last year. So you look at all these four teams, put the Ticats in there as well. Where would you slot Hamilton's O-line in a 1-4 situation here? And then how would you order these teams 1-4 as well? Are the Argos still the gold standard, or do you have the Ticats ahead of them? Where are you ranking these 1-4? And then where do you have the Ticats and why?
Okay, so I got Toronto at number one. I just think, I think they lost Trayvon Tate, but I'm not sure if he was even starting for them last year. On the offensive line, and they were just dominant last year. They really were. I think they gave up, I think it was in the teens with
sacks. Yeah, I think it was like 15 sacks. I think they gave up fewer sacks than they had games played.
Yes, correct. I believe you're correct on that. And it just blew away everybody in the league. You know, no one was touching them last year. So I still have them at number one because they lost basically no one along the line. I have Hamilton at number two because – and I think that Hamilton maybe can eclipse them as we go along here. But at this point in time, I have them at number two because of what we talked about previously. You know, I just think I'm just really high on this group. I like some of the veteran presence. I like the young guys that are coming up along that offensive line. I have Montreal at three. Like you mentioned last year, they were really, really bad early on in the season. They got better and better. I think it was partially because Cody Fajardo started playing better within the pocket. He wasn't running around like a maniac outside the pocket, you know, making it hard on his offensive line. I think they improved as it went along, but I'm still not ready to put them above Hamilton or Toronto. And then obviously I have Ottawa at number four. They eclipsed Montreal as the worst line as the season went on. I think they had the most sacks in the league given up. So they are stuck in at number four.
Yeah, so I got them ranked the same way as you do. I think Montreal and Hamilton are really cool. Like, the Argos, to me, until proven otherwise, are far and ahead of everybody. I do think Montreal's line or Hamilton's line could be better. You know, a lot of that's going to depend on quarterback play as well. Like, the Argos got really good quarterback play last year, and a guy who got rid of the ball or wasn't afraid to run. Maybe they don't have that this year. We're going to have to wait and see. I think Hamilton's line on paper looks better than Montreal's, but I think Montreal really only lost, like, Landon Rice. And I used to get into it with the guys at three down because there were a couple of guys there that were adamant that Landon Rice was one of the best, most underrated offensive linemen in the league. And I was like, guys, are we watching the same? Is this the same Landon Rice that couldn't get on the field with the Ticats that was a throw-in for the Johnny Manziel trade all those years ago? Like, he was a fine player, but I didn't think he was all that good. But other people that I used to work with really, really liked him. But I think winning that Grey Cup, it's one of those things where – you kind of give them the benefit of the doubt, even if I didn't love their line play last year. Like I said, I think it got better, but I think them and Hamilton could be in for a battle for that second spot. And like you, I have Ottawa in last just because Ottawa's got to show me before. Really, Ottawa's kind of in last for almost everything, because until you show me you can do it, or one of the other teams suffers some like major losses. You know what I mean? Like, oh, it was a really good unit last year, but 3/4 or 2/3 of their linebacking core are gone, or 4/5 of their offense. You know what I mean? Like, until one of the other teams in the division suffers some like dramatic losses at the spot, or the Red Blacks have really done a lot to buttress that group. They're in last for me right now because the pedigree's not there. The production's not there. I just don't feel as if Ottawa has earned any benefit of the doubt versus Montreal, where you might not be as high on them, but at the same time, you can look at them and be like, oh, maybe they will be pretty good.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how good they are going into the season after winning that Grey Cup, because like you mentioned, they didn't really lose anybody along the offensive line. Let's see. I'm curious to see if they can, you know, get off to a good start this year, opposed to their atrocious start of the season last year.
Yeah. So let's flip to the other side of the ball, because I think this is a much more significant overhaul that we saw on the defensive line. Jagaire Davis is gone, stalwart for many years, aside from that 1 year went to Toronto. A couple of fan favorites, Dylan Wynn, Ted Laurent, both gone as well. Kind of an ushering in of a new era on the defensive line. If you look at the group that we had when we went to the Grey Cup in 2021 versus the group that the team's going to try out there, I don't think there's very many names that are the same, even in backup positions. So in the place of some of these guys, the Ticats did bring in some youth, as you mentioned earlier. They went to the Argos, stole a couple players from them, and Brandon Barlow and Dwayne Hendricks, two guys that didn't. I think Hendricks started quite a bit. Barlow was more of a rotational guy, but he was second on the team in sacks last year. Hendricks was a very prominent player in the middle of that defensive line. They also added former BC line Montreal Alouette and Edmonton Elk Nick Usher, who has shown some pass rushing prowess in his career as well. Casey Sales returns with a brand new contract coming off an all-star campaign in 2023. And the team did bring back Jamal Davis and Mason Bennett as well, hoping that those guys, Davis in particular, who only was with the team for a short spell last year, can upgrade the pass rush that was sorely lacking last season, if we're being honest. So, Mike, you look at this kind of revamped defensive line. What do you like about this group? Do you think it's going to be better than the one we were excited about last year? What are your overall thoughts on where Hamilton's pass rush and defensive line group looks now versus maybe where we saw them a year ago? Because you remember last year, we were pretty high in this group as well, and they didn't live up to expectations in any measurable way.
Yeah, there was a lot of big name players that they brought in last year. A lot of guys that had spent time in the league that had established their name in the CFL. This year they did a different approach. Like we mentioned with the offensive line, you know, even more so with the defensive line, they went younger. You mentioned the guys that they brought in from Toronto. I think those are great signings. They're not proven players, and they are a bit of a gamble. You know, we don't know if the production is going to be the same or more than it was when they were rotation players. Because, you know, I know that Dwayne Hendricks had a lot of starting time, but Barlow is like, you know, how are they going to react to being full-time starters? It's much different, I assume, than being a rotation kind of guy. But I like this defensive line. I think they can be very productive. I think they're young and hungry and strong, and I think that they're going to be much better unit than they were last year, even though we lose guys like Dylan Wynn, who's an absolute beast, and I wish he was still on the team. But I think we replaced him, especially, you know, his position along the defensive tackle position in the middle of that defensive line, I think is really strong, and we just have to get pressure off the edges. So overall, I'm not as high on the defensive line as I am on the offensive line, but I still think they did a pretty darn good job in the offseason.
Are you looking at this group as more potential versus the O-line, where you see it as more of a proven production type of thing? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, they could be better than the offensive line. I don't know. Like, these guys that they brought in have shown that they can do great things with the Argos. And they're just coming into their prime, right? We're signing guys based on their potential, not what they have done necessarily. So I think they could be great. they could be dominant defensive line, but I just, it isn't proven to me yet.
Do they even have a 30-year-old on the defensive line? Like, I think Nick Usher's probably the oldest guy.
Yes, I
that
believe
they, that
I believe
they have, right. And he's maybe he's 30, maybe 31. I'm gonna look up the team. Where is he? Nick Usher was born in. This is thrilling for
he's
people.
He's 29.
He's 29, and I think he might be the oldest player on the defensive line because you look at. I can run off the rest of the names.
He is.
Barlow, Sales, Hendricks, Davis, Usher, Diallo, Bennett, Martin, Federico, Hewitt, Wilcots, and then the three newcomers, Sanders, Plant. Like, 29 years old is the oldest guy in the defensive line, and it's it's a guy who has what, 6 years of CFL experience, I think. Like, it's. It's not an overly experienced group, but like I said, it's and you said too, it's a group that might be entering their prime and coming into this all together. Casey Sales has been magnificent, was magnificent last year, was really good with the Bombers, but really, I thought really stepped up his game last year. Barlow to me is the interesting one because you're right. Didn't get a lot of playing time. And how is he going to react to being the man? Because we've seen some guys who have gone from role player rotational player to full-time guy and it doesn't work out, right? I just think he's what, 26? I think he's still to prove himself, probably still wants to try to get a shot at the NFL, quite frankly, if we're being perfectly honest. So I like this group. I like the youth of it. I like that there's guys, because even these younger guys like Usher, like Sales, who's what, 28, I think, has been in the league 4 years. Like, even with them not having a lot of tread on their tires, they've still been in the league a while. And then you see some of the Canadian guys they have, like Diallo's a guy that can start, has started in this league. Injuries were his trouble last year. If he stays healthy, he's probably the full-time starting defensive tackle besides Sales last season. But injuries took him out for a number of games. So if he can stay healthy, maybe he's better in a rotational role. They have some depth here as well. Not as much. I don't think they have as much depth as they do on the offensive line. But I think that there's some what ifs here, but I think it's more intrigue. Like, we're going to talk the next time we get together. We have one position group left. It's the linebackers. That, to me, I'm a little more scared there because there's a lot. Like, it's almost a complete set of unknowns at linebacker. Here, at least, I think there's enough veteran savvy with youth mixed in and depth that I feel pretty confident with this group. Like you, I don't know if I'm as confident. And again, this all is predicated on everybody staying healthy. I don't know if I'm as confident in the defensive line as I am in the offensive line, but I think I might be more intrigued by the defensive line. And granted, I think, frankly, it's going to come down to how these ends produce, right? Like, Casey Sales is probably still going to be great. I expect Dwayne Hendricks to perform really well beside him, just like Wynn and Laurent and Diallo and everyone else did last year. So I don't really see a drop off there. If anything, I think the interior is going to only get better. It's going to come down to whether Barlow, Davis, Usher, or whomever starts on the ends can get after the quarterback. That's what the Ticats didn't do very well last year. It's what they have to do well this year. And I think that's where we're going to ultimately, I know it's a rudimentary and it's a archaic caveman way, but we're going to look at the end of the season and go, did they increase their sack totals? Did they get more pressure? Did this defensive line disrupt? Because last season, I don't think they disrupted close to what we expected. That's what's going to make or break whether this defense ends up being good, is if those ends with larger roles with Barlow, more time with the team with Davis, or that veteran know-how with Usher can really get it done.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's gonna come down to the rush ends. And if they can't get pressure on the quarterback, then we're going to be in trouble. But the interior of the defensive line, I am not worried about at all. And I think they will. I think they'll at least one of these guys will be getting pressure off the edge and helping out the defense as a whole. So whether that be Nick Usher or Barlow or whoever, I don't care who it is. As long as we get pressure off the edges, I think the defense will be just fine.
You planting any flags on a double-digit sack season for anyone?
Let's go Barlow.
I was going to say, he had 9 last year in a rotational role. You got to think if he's going to get the majority of snaps out there, 10 should be within his wheelhouse.
I mean, if you get 9 sacks as a rotational player, that's damn impressive. This guy has this defensive line has a ton of potential. We don't know if it's going to be, you know, they're going to live up to that potential. But man, if Barlow is a guy that we think he can be, I think our defensive line will be just fine.
All right, so how do you stack this unit up with the rest of the East Division teams? The Argos, despite losing to two great players to the Ticats, they still look like they have a ferocious line. They still have Arimolade. Sean Oakman returned as well. They added Jake Ceresna in a trade with the Elks. The Owls suffered some losses. They lost three of their four starters from the Grey Cup. Lawal Uwiak signed in the NFL with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Sean Lemon recently announced his retirement, and Amondo Sewell remains unsigned and is not part of the Alouettes' plans for 2024. The Red Blacks still have Lorenzo Mauldin, who was the 2022 most outstanding defensive player, but he's coming off a down year. His sack totals went from 18 in 2022 to just 5 last year. And then you look around at the rest of that group, a lot of question marks surrounding them, including how long, like, Cleon Lang now becomes the elder statesman of Canadian interior offensive linemen with Ted Laurent gone. How long can he continue to play at the level that he has as he enters kind of the twilight year, similar to how where Laurent was the last couple of seasons? So you look at the four defensive line groups, it feels to me, looking on paper, that there's kind of two tiers here. There's two tiers of two teams and then two tiers of two other teams. But what about you? You look at these four squads, how are you going to rank them 1 through 4? And where do you slot this Ticats group right now?
Well, I got actually I have the same order as the D line. I have Toronto at number one. I have Hamilton at number two. I just think that they're, I don't know, I just feel like they're on paper are a better squad than what Montreal and Ottawa has. I'm not impressed with the Ottawa's defensive line. Like you mentioned, they have Mauldin, who had a great year 2 years ago, but only five sacks last year. And then who else did they have? You know, besides Cleon Lang in the middle, who's an aging player. Montreal, you mentioned the losses along the defensive line. I'm not really overly impressed with what they have on paper. Maybe I could be wrong. There could be guys coming up that we never heard of and do a great job. But at this point in time, I have Hamilton above Montreal and Ottawa, and I have Toronto at number one just because, you know, Toronto still had, even losing those two young guys to Hamilton, they still have a very good starting unit, and they brought in a guy like Ceresna, who was an absolute stud along the interior of the of a defensive line in Edmonton. So Hamilton number two, Toronto number one, Montreal three, Ottawa four.
Yeah, it was hard to rank them. Like, to me, I still give the Argos the benefit of the doubt. They still have Arimolade, still have Oakman, brought in Ceresna. They still have Robbie Smith. Like, there is a question at one of those rush end positions, but I think that they've shown. I mean, they brought Barlow into the league. You know what I mean? So I feel like they probably have someone buried on their depth chart that we don't know about that could turn into something. So I'll give them the benefit of the doubt now. They did lose their defensive coordinator, and that might, who was a former defensive lineman. So that might change things as well. So I'm not, things could, there's a lot of moving parts in Toronto, but I still think those three, Oakman, Ceresna, and Arimolade, like, they're so good that I think it could make up for if they have a weaker fourth starter. The Ticats, I got them sliding in second. I think on paper, this could be a really ferocious, talented group. And I, it's not just that I like Hamilton's group better, but I don't really like the other two. Like, the Owls still have Mustafa Johnson, who's really good. They brought in Dylan Wynn. If he's healthy, he's going to be fantastic for them. But the rest of that unit is kind of a question mark. Like, they have Avery Ellis, who's hasn't he's been good, but when's the last time he was really a legit playmaker? Like, it was back when he was playing for Ottawa pre-COVID pandemic. So it's been a while since Avery Ellis has really been a household name, you know what I mean? But and then you have the Red Blacks. Mauldin's good. I mean, they did bring back all four of their top sack guys from last year. Bryce Carter finished with 12, but Cleon Lang was second with 7. And we know Mauldin can get after the quarterback, he has in the past, but was that a 1 year blip? Or was last year the 1 year, you know what I mean? Like, which was it? Was it the high or the low that he, and he's a year older now, injured a bit last year. So there's questions there. It's hard to go 1 through 4. I ended up ranking them Toronto, Hamilton, Ottawa, Montreal. But to me, it's kind of the Argos slightly ahead of the Ticats, and then a gulf between the Red Black than between the Ticats and the Red Blacks and the Isles. It's just a lot more question marks over there. I think I'd be higher on Montreal if they didn't lose three of their four Grey Cup starters. And I know that Sewell, like Amando Sewell, was older. I know that Lemon was older, but Lemon was great for them last year. Like, he led the team in sacks and he came in like mid-season. So I don't know. It to me, I got to see more from them. Again, I know we give them the benefit of the doubt in other areas. I'm not willing to give them the benefit of the doubt on the defensive line when all of these guys, there's a lot of new faces there on that D line. So it's, I think the Ticats are closer to the top than they are to the bottom, which is really nice to say after what we saw last season.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be, it's going to be interesting to see how this young defensive line performs. We've been, you know, I think Hamilton fans, you know, love their defense and they love their defensive linemen getting after the quarterback. So hopefully we can bring that unit back to prosperity this year and, you know, get near the top of the D-line rankings.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last time? I guess 2019, probably the best defensive line this team's had in the last few years, you know what I mean? But outside of that, we've been waiting for that that stud pass rusher to take over the mantle from Big Joe 25-some odd years ago now. Yeah. So maybe they have the guy now, maybe they don't. I guess we'll have to wait and see, right? I mean, I'm not trying to heap any sky-high expectations on to be the next Joe Montford, because I don't think we're ever going to see someone record like 85 sacks over four seasons, but it'd be nice if the Ticats could have someone reach double digits this year.
Yeah, I think Brandon Barlow is going to get 27 sacks this year. Just break that record, you know? It was 26 and a half. Or was it 24 and a half that he got?
I think it's 26 and a half. Because Joe had 26 one season this half stat. The season that Joe Montford did not win most outstanding defensive player, he had 26 sacks.
Yes. Outrageous.
Just telling you how great he was. All right. Unfortunately, we now have to turn from fun news to more depressing stuff with the latest on the Chad Kelly lawsuit. I don't want to talk about this, but there is some new information that we have had over the past couple of weeks. An additional claim has been made by the coach that is suing Kelly and the Argos for allegedly harassing her. The big one is this incident that's referred to as the Bills incident has now come to light and added to the suit. So according to the suit, Kelly arranged for some free tickets to a Buffalo Bills game in October of 2022. And Kelly was adamant that the group that was going, which included this coach, was to get an Airbnb to stay the night in Buffalo, which to me is very odd considering how close Toronto is to Buffalo. But I'll try not to interject any opinions until we get through sort of the nitty gritty here. The coach told Kelly, the coach that is the female coach that is suing Kelly, said that she was not interested in that arrangement. But according to the suit, Kelly persisted and then got furious with her when she went to Mike Pinball Clemens to tell him of these plans, asking for kind of permission, so to speak, to go here, which Clemens gave and said it was a good idea for her to go down there, to go to an NFL game, to kind of network with people in the NFL. Kelly then, according to the suit, allegedly said that she shouldn't have said anything to Pinball and that she said she did so to protect her job and that the only way she would go to the game is if she got clearance from team management to do it. Not long after that, again, according to the suit, Kelly revoked the free invite, said that this coach now had to pay for her ticket, which she declined and then never went to the game. She then says that this escalated Kelly's harassment of her. He kept trying to plan movie and dinner dates with her, which she repeatedly declined. Then after all of that, that's kind of the new stuff that we got in the suit. All this comes out, as well as a report by Arash Madani talking about female staff members at the league level resigned over concerns with how the league was handling this, especially and name dropped Commissioner Randy Ambrosi and quote unquote senior staff. This brought Nathan Rourke into the picture, former BC Lions quarterback, current quarterback for the New England Patriots, who tweeted out that he was disappointed in the lack of urgency expressed by both the CFL and the Toronto Argonauts in dealing with this situation. As a reminder, the league launched their own internal investigation into these allegations at the end of February. We are now careening very close to the end of April and the start of training camp, and there's still been no sort of resolution to this. This, Mike, to me, curious how you think, is getting uglier the longer this goes on. Just what are your thoughts on these new allegations against Kelly and the report that the CFL might not be handling this as well as many females that used to work in the league office had hoped?
Yeah, it's disappointing. It reeks of desperation from the league and from the Toronto Argonauts to kind of sweep this under the rug, saying they're going to do an investigation. And, you know, it's been months and months and months. You know, it kind of seems to me like they just want everyone to forget about it and, you know, move on. And that's just not going to happen. So to me, you know, the new additions to the lawsuit, I think, bring more merit to it. You know, there's certain situations and certain instances that are very detailed, and there's witnesses, and it's just, it just doesn't look good for the Argonauts, and it doesn't look good for the CFL, and I think it's very disappointing, and that's all I really have to say about it right now.
Did you see, who was it, Derek Dennis, I think, talked about, you know, it's kind of interesting how this is allowed to drag on considering the team and the player, and then that kind of got him a little bit of some backlash. I think he even said that, like, Chad Kelly blocked him on social media. I've made my stance on this known. I think you have as well. Like you, I think the more information that gets added just provides more merit to these allegations. I sadly still don't think the league is going to handle this properly. The fact that according to a very credible, you can think of whatever you want about Arash Madani, he's a credible reporter. I know people dislike the guy, us included, because he seems to relish in bashing the league, but he holds them to account, which is, I think, something that is important. I don't think that he would release a statement like this or tweet something out or write a report on this if it wasn't true. So if league office employees, female ones, are concerned with how this is being handled by the commissioner and other senior members of the league staff, I think that's concerning. I think, like, the whole thing is, it's gross. You know what I mean? And I just don't understand what the league hopes to get by pushing this onward. Like, you've heard of, like, today, for, I'm going to kind of go all over the place because my thoughts are kind of all over the place here. The Jontay Porter incident in the NBA, where he was, that just this afternoon as we're recording this, was banned for life for playing in the NBA for gambling. That situation, the news of that situation came out after this Kelly thing, and the NBA did an investigation and has a resolution to it in the span of like a month. Mm-hmm. And you're telling me the CFL can't, like, what is taking so long? You know what, like,
well, it's their star, right? It's their big star. Listen, if the NBA did that so quickly because it hurts their league. You know what I mean? If we see it, there's no morals in this world. It's all about making money. And yeah. I mean, we see it in the NFL with
why Deshaun Watson has a $250 million contract.
Yeah, it's like if the NBA did that so quickly because they don't want other players betting on their league, you know, making the game more muddy than it already is. If there was, say, if it was LeBron James, you think they'd be kicking him out so quickly? I think they'd be covering it up. And or Kevin Durant or whoever, not pick on LeBron James.
I don't know. Pete Rose got banned for life pretty quickly in baseball. And Pete Rose is the all-time hits leader and a surefire Hall of Famer. And now he's barred from the game of baseball. So
yeah,
maybe they would. Maybe they would. I mean, the gambling thing, it's different with gambling just because it's.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is.
It's totally something. Different. But, you know, the Deshaun Watson incident is another. It's.
I don't want to be a whataboutism kind of thing.
Yes, I agree.
Just saying, this is how things are handled in the real world. Like, I'm sorry if people are offended by that, but we all know that at the end of the day, nothing matters more than money. So if they feel like Chad Kelly can bring money to the league, can bring money to the Toronto Argonauts, they're going to do everything in their power to have him on the field. So I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, it's like that line from Fight Club where at the beginning of the movie where it's like, is the cost of settling the lawsuits cheaper than the cost of recalling the vehicles? And is the cost of what this will cost the league, should they not punish Kelly, less than what it would cost the league if they did.
Right.
I don't think, this is my opinion, because I don't think there's any player, one player in the CFL. Like you mentioned LeBron James, you mentioned Kevin Durant. There's been players across leagues in hockey, you know, Sidney Crosby, Austin Matthews, Connor McDavid, like superstar players. I don't think there's one player in the CFL that the CFL could get rid of that would change. Like, I think should these, and I believe these allegations, but should they be proven credible and Kelly's gone? I don't think it changed anything. I don't think they, no. I think dragging this out hurts them more than getting rid of Kelly would. Because I've seen people now, how many people will actually do it? I don't know, but I've seen people say, I'm not going to Argos games. Mm-hmm. I'm not watching Argos games this year. I'm sure some people, but even if one person who had season tickets decides, you know what, I'm getting rid of them. I'm not going back. I'm done with them. It hurts. And whether that it ends up being reflected in the bottom line or not, it's neither here nor there, but I don't think that there's any negatives, because the people who are supporting Chad Kelly do so because of the color of the jersey he wears. I don't think they're going to stop doing that if they boot him from the league, in the same way that all those Hamilton Ticat fans that bought Johnny Manziel jerseys didn't stop watching Ticats games when he got traded and then booted from the, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think there's any one player in the CFL, and I couldn't tell you the last time. I don't think there's maybe ever been a player in the CFL that his removal from the league would damage the league to such an extent. I think Kelly's continued employment is more damaging than his removal would be. And the thing is I've been attacked for 2 months now with my stance on Chad Kelly, but my whole thing has been, why wasn't he just indefinitely suspended pending the, like, that's the thing I don't understand. Like, that's the easy out here. It was, okay, you know what? He's banned from team activities. He's, you know what I mean? Like, if this isn't resolved by training camp, he's not allowed to come to camp. He's suspended indefinitely pending this investigation. I don't know why they just didn't do that. I think you would have eliminated a lot of animosity that fans, Argos fans and CFL fans alike, have had towards this if you did something as simple as that. And I don't want to hear the guilty until or innocent until proven guilty thing, because there's a litany of guys. No one made this stink when Nate Hawley had his contract revoked because of allegations against him. No one cared when Jerome Messam was cut when allegations came out against him. He's the reigning MOP, and Argo fans finally have a quarterback that can lead them to the promised land, and they are afraid of what the team will look like without him. I think it's as simple as that. And I don't think Kelly staying in the league makes a damn bit of difference. I really don't. Like, maybe the Argos won't be very good, but I don't think the marketing of the league or anything like that changes.
No, I don't think it's just not the nature of the league. It's not a superstar driven league. No. Like, Doug Flutie
left. Did that harm the league in any? No. You know what I mean?
No, like, not really. I mean, some of the worst times in the league's history. He was the guy. He was the guy. So. It's just not a star driven league, but I think that they think that though. I think that they are worried that, the Toronto Argonauts, when I say this, are worried that they're going to lose their momentum or whatever, even though it wasn't even momentum. I mean, they had like maybe 1,000 or so more people at games each on average or something like that. But that's what I'm thinking. I don't know what else would be the reasoning behind them being so hush hush and everything like that. It's like, I don't know, man. It's just a big mess, and I'm glad it's not the Hamilton Tiger Cats. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, but you know what? We did deal with something like this, and I've been really hesitant, because you said it earlier, like, it's not a comparison thing. It's not a what about thing, and I've been super hesitant to bring up the Art Briles thing, but looking at the response to that versus the response to this, it's kind of night and day, is it not? Like, we did a whole podcast about our
emergency
brides.
Podcast. We did one right away.
Did one right away. Ticat
and the fans' reaction too. The fans, I mean, the Hamilton fans were
instantaneous,
mad, so really quick, mad.
So quickly that before the end of day, that whole thing had been taken care of, and that is a black mark on this team that I still think still hangs over them to this day. Where is, like, again, I guess at the time I was still working for 3Down at the time. So I guess I was media and we were doing this, and I guess we're the new former media. Where's Argos Media on this? Where is the independent non-team affiliate? Like, I get why Mike Hogan, you know, Team Shill, right, isn't writing articles for Argonauts.ca about this. Like, whatever. I understand that. But how come nobody, like, there's independent Argos Media out there. There's a guy that works for 3Down who covers the Argos. There's guys who work for 3Down that cover the league, quote unquote. How come no one is taking them to task for this? When Art Briles was hired, we did a pod. I wrote a piece about it. We talked about, like, are we going to support this team? Like, again, I'm not trying to make it an us versus them or we're better. Like, that's not what this is about. But I'm just saying the difference in response to me has been jarring. It's been gross from a number of perspectives, but to me, the silence on this all, the silence from the Argos, the silence from the league, and the silence from independent people that cover the Toronto Argonauts and the Canadian Football League, to me has been gross. It says more about maybe their intentions than had they just come out and said something where they support Kelly, if I'm being honest. You say nothing, you're just as complicit as if you supported, in my opinion.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm with you on the Mike Hogan thing. Like, I get it. Like, it'd be nice if he said something, but I get why he doesn't. He works for the team. You know, that's his job. He's not going to bite the hand that feeds like Kelly did, you know, on Twitter recently. But, yeah, the independent guys, you know, Ben Grant at 3Down Nation, pretty disappointing, man. Like, and other people, too. It's like, Ben does the play-by-play with Mike Hogan. I don't know if that means he works for the team or he works for TSN. Maybe that's why he hasn't said anything. But, like, I don't know, man. It seems very odd to me that
Ben came from the X's and Argos website, and they have other guys there. It's not just Ben. There's a whole website of guys that cover that team that do podcasts with Ben. They haven't said a damn thing either. It's not just Ben. And I like Ben. Ben's a good guy. I enjoyed my time working with Ben.
Yeah,
I'm a little disappointed in him as well. I do wonder if, given his role on the radio broadcast, maybe it's similar to Hogan's. But there are other guys out there that cover this team. It's not just him. And that, to me, the fact that there's radio silence there is disappointing as well.
Yeah.
And don't give me that we're waiting for the facts to come out, because if there were other because the facts are out. They're just not the facts you want to hear. Like, you can say, like, you don't, the innocent until proven guilty people are like, well, we don't know both sides. You don't need to know both sides. Like, no one does these things with, you don't file a lawsuit in.
Yeah. Ontario. And it's not like she's going to get rich off this shit. She's suing for like $80,000 or something like that. Like, that's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not life changing money. So it's like, come on, like, it's, yeah, I'm with you. I just think that, I mean, the stories are there. I think the witnesses are there. I don't think she's lying. And it's disappointing to see that people around the team aren't saying anything because they're covering the team or they're fans of the team. Unlike, like how we covered the Uprise thing. And I don't want to keep going back to that, but we were pissed off, man. Like, I remember I had my Ticats hat on that day. I was about to leave to go out into the public, and I was like, no, I'm not wearing my Ticats shit today.
Yep,
I'm not a fan of them right now. I'm fucking pissed off at them, and it's disappointing not to see the same reaction to a very similar thing from the Toronto Argonauts fans and media.
I did the same thing. I stopped wearing Ticats gear the rest of that season. I wore black. I mean, I wear black most of the time. Most of my shirts are black or gray or what have you. I stopped wearing the team colors as well, because I was disappointed, and I didn't buy any new merchandise. I didn't wear any merchandise. I didn't want to promote the team. And
because it was such a boneheaded decision. It was such a boneheaded decision on their part to even think that this would be, you know, accepted in any way. So I'm with you. It was very, very disappointing.
Well, and the other thing that leads me to believe that these things are, these allegations are more than likely true, is the way that Kelly comports himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he acts like a douchebag.
Yeah, a bro, like,
the whole Caitlin Clark, like you mentioned in passing, he tweets out Caitlin Clark, who was the biggest star in college basketball at the time, went number one overall in the WNBA draft. Someone put out a picture of what her salary will be, and it's in like the $80,000 to $90,000 range over 4 years. And Kelly goes, "Oh, that's CFL money." And it's like, what do you do? Like, does he have like the worst PR people in the world? Like, you see something like that and you're just like, he just doesn't get it. He just doesn't get it. And maybe it's a life of, I mean, he's had incidents in the past. It's a life of always getting away with everything. You know what I mean? So maybe he just thinks he's untouchable. And that kind of annoys me as well, because I would hope, or I want us as a society to stop being okay with, you know, boy plays sports well or does music well, or like, let's stop. Just because someone has a talent at something doesn't mean they should be able to get away with murder. And I understand in the real world, that's not how it happens. Mm-hmm. You're a superstar. You get chance after chance. I totally get that. But it's not as if this isn't a multi-billion dollar industry. This isn't a league that needs Chad Kelly as the face of it. You can find somebody else. There's always somebody else. There's always someone ready to come and take that spot. For this to be dragging on now into the start of training camp, I think it's a bad look for the CFL. I think it's a bad look for the Argos. And it's one of those things that it brings into focus, like, should I be spending my free time giving a crap about this product if the people running it don't give a crap about things like this? And I understand, yes, I watch NFL football, and yes, I've watched Deshaun Watson play. I understand there's hypocrisy there and all of that. I just do wonder if this continuing to be dragged on does more harm than good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it definitely does more harm. And I just don't understand what he was trying to convey with that tweet. It's like, you're not.
That he's an idiot. He's a fucking idiot.
Yeah. And it's not even necessarily the tweet. It's like, he's accurate in like the rookie contracts, like it's around that level of money. But like, dude, you're getting paid over $600,000. You got, you know, kicked out of the NFL. Nobody wants you in the NFL. You come to see the CFL, you play well, you get a second chance. You're getting paid handsomely, not by NFL standards, but by CFL standards. You're making a ton of money. And by regular
life standards, someone handed me $600,000, I'd be perfectly happy.
I'd be over the moon. I mean, that's a lot of money for a regular Joe like ourselves. And, you know, it's not like this is the first incident. He's had a troubled history. I think, I don't know this for a fact. It's just my assumption. I think he has a problem with alcohol or something like that.
He did. Definitely did.
He did. Yeah.
He drunkenly stumbled into someone else's home when he was with, I think he was with the Broncos. Yes. And he walked into someone else's house and was so drunk he didn't realize where he was.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's that recent video of him on Instagram where he appeared to be inebriated. I don't know what he was talking about or what the circumstances were around that Instagram post, but it just didn't look good. So I think he has problems and he needs to, you know, smarten up. I don't think he's going to be, you know, if he's out of the league, I'll be happy. Because of all these accusations, and I think he's gotten his second and third chances. Yeah. You know, I believe in second chances. I don't necessarily believe in third and fourth chances. If you show yourself that many times, that's who you are, basically.
Yeah, I'm the same. And I know a lot of people want to compare this to the Johnny Manziel situation. And I was willing to give Manziel, he had one opportunity in this league. If he came up here, kept his nose clean, I was fine with that. As soon as he didn't, all right, see ya, buddy. You couldn't hack it. It's the same with this. I'm fine with giving guys second chances. I'm fine with letting guys, if they've truly changed, people make mistakes. I've made mistakes. You've made mistakes. Everyone listening to this has made mistakes. That's human nature. It's whether you learn and grow from them that changes. That's whether I can accept the fact that you have earned and can continue to earn that second chance. But he's had a second chance. This is like his fifth chance, and he's pissing it away. And I just hope that one day we can come on here and talk about the fact that he's gone. I am not delusional enough to believe that's going to be the case. I just hope it is. It is one day. Let's talk about something a little lighter, shall we? That was a heavy topic. We spent way more time on it than I wanted to, but I think it's an important thing for us to discuss. But let's end the show with some things that annoy me, but to a much less significant degree. Mike, the Hamilton Tiger Cats finally, after years, are selling mini replica football helmets. I love trinkets and knickknacks. They're some of my, I have a giant bookshelf that I bought from IKEA that is just filled with Ticats, 49ers, Forge, trinkets and knickknacks, beer cans, cups, Lego figures. I have a mini San Francisco 49ers replica helmet that I bought a couple of years ago. Ticats are selling one. I'm over the moon. I go to the Ticats store. I see, because the Forge FC home opener was this past weekend. First time I've been down there since the Grey Cup. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. They have them. I picked one up. I was ready to buy it. I flip it over. It's $66.99 for a replica mini helmet. Mike, am I insane? Or is that a ludicrous price for an item such as that? For comparison purposes, I bought my Niners one. I bought it from an American website. It cost me $40. Why am I paying with tax $75 for a CFL one? I think it's insane. Am I crazy to think that, or is that just a stupidly outrageous price?
No, it's been like this for years. It's not just the mini helmet. It's everything. You know, it's like I've been complaining about this. I know that we've both been complaining this for many years. I don't get it. Like, if you can buy NFL merchandise cheaper, like, it shouldn't be that way. Now, maybe they're thinking we'll price it higher because we're not going to sell as much, and that's obviously true, but you shouldn't be ripping off your fans. You know, the Hamilton Tiger Cat fans are a loyal bunch. You know what I mean? The Saskatchewan Rough Rider fans are a loyal bunch, and they're going through the same thing. It's league-wide for the most part. Maybe there's some teams that are cheaper than others. I'm not sure because I don't really look into other teams' merchandise, but it's unnecessary. You know, the jersey prices are crazy. You know, buying a pair of jogging pants is like $110 or something stupid. It's been like this forever, and it needs to stop. Like, lower the prices a little bit so you can sell more. It's the same way with like tickets to games. Now, I don't want them to lower the prices so much for tickets that you devalue your product, but for instance, when you have a huge stadium like in Edmonton, and I know that they cut down the attendance, it's going to be the bottom portion of the stadium this year, around 30,000. But when they were selling all those, you know, the whole stadium, why not make cheap tickets in the upper deck so you can sell some tickets, get some more revenue from beer sales or popcorn or hot dogs or whatever? Lower the prices and you'll sell more. I just don't understand their logic of outpricing their audience, essentially. It's crazy.
It's just, I understand things cost more. Things shouldn't cost that much more 4 years, 3 years later. Like, and the thing is, if you go onto the site that I bought the Niners helmet, same price. Still like $34.99. Yeah. Like, I just don't.
How much CFL merchandise does it cost to produce? How much does it cost to produce a plastic helmet? Like, really?
I mean, honestly, it's probably cheaper for me if I went to the supplier, bought a blank,
painted it yourself,
black helmet, and made the stickers at home myself.
Yeah.
Like, I want one of these things. I'm a knickknack guy. I like having I feel like having knickknacks around your house makes your house feel like a home. Like, I don't want my house to feel sterile. You know what I mean? Like, where there's nothing on the walls. Like, I got this like flag and scarf motif that sits behind my computer that I look at every time I sit down to record. I got like my computer room is just filled with memorabilia from all the teams I like to cheer for. I like that kind of stuff. I know it's collects dust and it's silly. And when I die, it's not going to matter. Like, it's all going to get thrown in a landfill somewhere probably. But while I'm here, I want to enjoy my stuff. I like my little knickknacks. I mean, the Forge game, they just gave out a replica championship medal, and it was like I couldn't wait to get it because it's just another thing to add to the collection. And again, I get it, all this thing's going to go away when I'm dead, but while I'm here, these things, I find them kind of neat. Yes. I'm not paying $70 for a helmet. I'm just not. I'd be hard pressed to pay that for a real helmet. You know what I mean? Like, and I get that I'm being facetious there, obviously, but it's just, it's out of this world. Like, it's just $50 for a t-shirt, whatever. I think that's too stupid expensive, but at least a t-shirt I can wear once a week or twice a week, if I, depending on when I do laundry. And it's like, I feel like I'll get my money's worth out of a t-shirt. A fun trinket I just want to kind of look at to kind of complete a set, so to speak. I just can't justify that much money. So I do have some other things I want to talk about, though, too. These are not Ticat specific things, Mike. Theme games. You've heard about this phenomenon theme, like where each game has like a theme. The Riders just announced their theme games, and it caused this uproar because they weren't very inventive or something. Why do we care? Like, why do you go to a football game, Mike? Is it because it's a country western theme or a superhero theme or a pro wrestling theme or a whatever? Or do you go because you want to watch a football game? Like, this is what I love the Pride game because I think that's a good thing. I loved when they did the CFL pink thing because I think the Indigenous games, like, I think those are important things. This is a way to kind of use sports to elevate societal issues, which I don't care how many people say keep politics out of sports. You think that, you're an idiot. Politics and sports are intrinsically intertwined. I don't even like, you want to do like a end of season seat holder, fan appreciation night. Okay, cool. Do I need to have country western night at the game to get me excited? No. And I don't, and people were furious about this stuff. Does it make any sense to you? Am I out to lunch here? Or do you think these theme games are the outrage over the theme games is overblown? I think it's manufactured. I think people are looking for something to be upset about. That's just my opinion.
I'm with you. I just couldn't care less about these theme games. Like, I do go to less so when I went to Edmonton games a lot, because it's more of a social experience for me, because I don't really care about the team necessarily. I was there to watch a football game, but I was also there to talk to people and but I didn't give a fuck if it was country. And why is it always country western night? Can we get a different genre of music night kind of a thing? You know what I mean? But I don't care if it's 90s night or 80s night or whatever. Just put a good product on the field. And I get it. You can't just throw the product on the field and then do nothing else, because, you know, the competition in this world is through the roof. So you have to have those knickknacks and you have to have those special things. But to me, it just doesn't matter. And I think that people are losing their minds over nothing. Because listen, I get that Saskatchewan has been greedy over the last couple of years, and they've taken advantage of their fan base, and you see it in their attendance. You know, it's not what it used to be. But you have a brand new stadium. You know, maybe the team will be good this year, I'm not sure. And I'm not saying you can't complain, but to me, this is a little silly. Like, can we complain about something else that actually matters? Like, theme night, they're trying to do something. And if you don't like it, then so be it. But, like, it's not a up in arms type of thing to me.
Is it just because there's nothing else to talk about right now? Like, I know the draft's perhaps coming up, but let's be honest, most casual, even some hardcore observers of the league, don't really know how to handicap the draft or look at the draft with a critical eye. We haven't hit training camp yet. We're still in that, like, that little bit of a lull period. Is that just what this is about? This is something that maybe generates some conversations, and if it generates anger, so be it. All publicity is good publicity type thing. Cause like, if they announce these things on the eve of training camp, I don't think anyone would give a damn.
No, I agree. I saw them, a lot of Saskatchewan fans being reacting to Edmonton's theme nights, being like, oh, this is how you do it. And it's like, I don't know. I didn't see Saskatchewan themes nights, but to me, Edmonton didn't really do anything that is reinventing the wheel either. So I don't get it. I think that you might be right. There's nothing going on right now, so this is all they have to talk about.
And do these things sell tickets? Like, is someone more inclined to go to a game because it's superhero? Like, they've done superhero days at like Forge and Ticats games. And like, I think they did one where it was like, they do one every year at the Forge games where it's the mascot's birthday. So they bring in a bunch of other like Stripes and TC are there, and they bring in like the Hamilton Cardinals mascot, or they bring in the Bulldog. I think they used to bring in the Honey Badger, and then they bring in like, you know, Spider-Man or whatever. and they do like a race at halftime. And it was like, okay, it's a fine, it's a cute thing, whatever, but not something that they, you know what I mean? Like it's, I don't think that that would bring more people. I do know like they would do like Halloween things where kids could dress up. And to me, like if you're doing it for kids, like whatever, like that's the thing with like a lot of these theme games are geared towards children. Are they not? Like it's it's a chance for a kid to dress up and go to a game. Like why adults care? I don't understand.
There was one last year, and I think they're doing again this year in Edmonton. It was like some competition between like the universities and colleges, and they bring like a lot of students in. And I think that's a really good idea. Yeah. I think it boosted attendance and you know maybe get younger people interested. I think that's a great idea, and I think they're doing it again this year. So that's a really smart one. But to me, like the '90s night and the '80s night and country music night, it just doesn't matter to me.
Well, see, I'm not against theme nights, like the throwback nights. Like, remember back in like the late aughts, early 2010s, where they did the throwback weeks and they would wear the old uniforms, they would play the old music. Like, that's neat. It didn't change my opinion on buying a ticket or not. Like,
no, it's not gonna bring in the casual fan.
Regardless or not going regardless.
There's not a person out there that's gonna like, you know, doesn't go to CFL games and then, oh, it's a '90s night. Oh, I'm gonna go now. I just don't think that's how it works.
Yeah, I don't think it is either. All right, we've gone a little bit long. I had one more thing I wanted to talk about, but I think we should just put a pin into it. Maybe I'll save it for later. I think ending on theme games is probably the best way to go. So that was Podski Review for this week. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw.